Today's lesson is titled An Invitation to an Extraordinary Life. We're going to look at the story of Jesus walking on water and also Peter climbing on and out of the boat. And we're just going to talk about how God called us to an extraordinary life, and he wants us to have a great extraordinary life. And we're just going to make a case through Peter today. So I'm going to start reading Matthew chapter 14, verse 22. Before we even read this, let me introduce the subject. Before I read the paragraph that we're supposed to read today, which is Matthew 14, 22, I'm going to give you the day of Jesus on that day. He gets up that day. He gets the news. If you read a little before Matthew 14, 22, he gets the news that his cousin, John the Baptist, is beheaded. He wants to withdraw to a lonely place to pray. He sees the crowds coming. The crowds come. And at some point, he heals their sick that day. And then at some point, they notice that that people didn't have food. And they ask Jesus to dismiss the crowd so they can go to the nearby villages to get food. Jesus says, you don't have to send them away. We will give something. We will give something to eat. We'll give them something to eat. They find a young man or a young boy with two fish, five breads and two fish. And they take it. They take his lunch or dinner. His mother packed, or he just grabbed it before he ran out of home. And Jesus multiplies and feeds the 5,000 men plus women and children. And he dismisses them. And Jesus, in the evening, is there. He sends the disciples across the Sea of Galilee, and then he goes up and start praying. At some point, at the fourth watch of the night, he gets out of the mountain and starts walking on the water toward the boat. So just a little background to the fourth watch of the night. Roman watches were from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. They divided up to four time slots where the guards will keep watch, 6 to 9, 9 to 12, 12 to 3, 3 to 6. The fourth watch would have been 3 to 6 a.m. on the morning. So that means Jesus was praying there for quite a bit. And here we are picking up the story in Matthew 14. He's going to walk. He sends his disciples on a boat. They're struggling, and now he's going to walk to them. So this is Matthew 14, verse 22. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on the mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone. And the boat was already a considerable distance from the land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it is you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why did you doubt?" When they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." This is not the first time they were on a boat and the wind was against them and the waves were filling into the boat. Matthew 8, we have another story, but this time Jesus was in the boat. In Matthew 8, 22-27, you don't have to open there. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us. We're going to drown." He replied, "You have little faith. Why are you so afraid?" And he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, "What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." So in the first instance, when they were in danger, they just walked Jesus up. Jesus was already in the boat, and they were amazed that he commanded the waves and the wind. And they notice they end the story ends. The men were amazed and asked, "What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." You're going to notice in Matthew 14:32, it says, "When they climb into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, 'Truly, you are the Son of God.'" I don't know if you see how their faith, in the first time they were afraid, in the second time, this Matthew 14 passage, they're not afraid of the wind and the waves. There's no record of it. If you read it, you're not going to find any record that they were afraid. So they learned from the first instant that God is in control, Jesus is in control. They learned their faith has grown. But significant enough that in this case, the second one in Matthew 14, Peter decides that he wants to walk on water. Have you ever thought to yourself, why? Why did Peter wanted to get out of the boat and walk to Jesus? If you were there, would you have walked out of the boat and walk on water toward Jesus? Is there a record of anybody in the Bible ever walked on water other than Jesus? Can you recall anybody in the Old Testament ever walked on water? This was extraordinary. Why did Peter felt like he wanted to walk on water? And actually, if you read verse 28 of Matthew 14, "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. He actually did walk on water. We quickly focus on him sinking, but we don't know how long he walked on water before he started sinking. My question is to you, why did he want to walk on water? And if you were him, is it better that you walked on water and you sank than you never walked on water? You never came out of the boat. I know for myself, I'd rather walk on water and sink than never step out of the boat. Have you ever thought about that? And when he's sinking, what does he do quickly? What is his cry? "Lord, save me." Right? Verse 30, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out of his hand and caught him. Immediately. An invitation to an extraordinary life. And then later on, they determine that he's the Son of God. Now they're worshiping him. In the first one, they say, "What kind of man is this that is commanding the waves and the wind?" And now, like, they're like, "Man, he's no man. He's no man." And then they reach to the other side. I will tell you something. Do you think that Peter went home and told his wife and his mother-in-law that he walked on water that day? He was a fisherman. This is the water that he always got on to fish. He actually, how many witnesses he had that he walked on water? All of the apostles are there, and Jesus, that means there were 12 witnesses that Peter walked on water. You're gonna say, why so significant? Man, we're called to an extraordinary life, and where I'm gonna explore this today, that invitation stands for me and for you if you wanna walk on water. And I don't mean literally. We're going to talk about this. I will tell you a story. I think when I was 13, I had two cousins. My father has two brothers. So three cousins from three different siblings, three brothers, were on a boat in the Sea of Marmara. We rented a rowboat to row to this island, not the one that has the lighthouse on it, but to the right, the big one. We decided we're gonna leave in the morning, we're gonna row there together, and we're gonna go to the grocery store, have lunch, snacks, candies, drinks, and we're gonna enjoy ourselves on that particular island because we've never been there, and then we're gonna row back. Beautiful day. on the way back, the wind is against us. And the wave starts to come into our boat, and we're not making a headway anymore. I'm 13. I think one of my cousins was 12, and the oldest one maybe 15, 16. 15, 16 was trying to empty the water, and I'm trying to row because I was the bigger guy. For a long time, we went against the wind and the waves, and I thought we're gonna die. It is a real threat when you're in the waters and there are wind and the waves. This is a real thing. And disciples know that. That's why they were terrified. They know they will die. They know people have died in the waters. Peter uses this language in 2 Peter chapter 1. You don't have to turn there. This is 2 Peter chapter 1, 3 and 4. It says, His divine power has given us everything. I'm clipping the words. So that you may participate in the divine nature. His divine power has given us everything. And so that you may participate in His divine nature. What is participating in divine nature of God or Jesus means? Extraordinary stuff. Divine power and divine nature that we can participate. As we know, Peter was a less than ordinary. He was a fisherman. He was illiterate. He barely had any money to his name, perhaps. Right? If you think about it. But in Matthew 10, when Jesus chose the 12, He gave them authority to heal the sick, to raise the dead, to cleanse the lepers, and cast out demons. Again, I'll read it. Heal the sick. This is Matthew chapter 10. Raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. He gave them authority. What is an authority? Power. So there's the, like, if you think about a military, who's the top person? It's a 5-star general. And who's the lowest person? It's called a private. Private has no authority. Nobody is underneath him. And everybody is underneath the general. General is entrusted with the entire, perhaps, army or a section of the army. He's given authority. Authority is not something that you can just easily possess yourself. It has to be given. Jesus gives them authority to do these things. I remember when I was working, I was young, again, I think it was in high school. My cousin, one of my cousins had all of my family members were in the fur business. Everybody. And my cousin had a business. He maybe had about 20 to 30 employees, and they will fashion fur for customers. And he had a space full of expensive furs, hundreds of thousands of dollars of items. We're talking about like 30, 40 years ago. A fur coat that he was selling was $4,000 or $5,000 in the 80s. We're talking about the real mink stuff. It was custom tailored. It was several thousand then. So when I was working for him part-time, he decides that he's gonna give me the key to this place so that if any of the employees wanted to access something, they had to go through me. So imagine, you know, John, somebody needs expensive bottle or something, you have to come to me so that I can open up the cellar so you can take one because and I didn't know why he did that, but he had some trust issues. One time, I see a large amount of cash sitting on the counter somewhere. Large amount of cash. And I found my cousin, my uncle's son. I said, look, you left a large amount of cash over there. You know what he told me? He said that he was suspecting one of his employees was stealing, so he put that there to see if the person will take it or not. He was testing this lady. She had like 20, 30 people working. There were a lot of expensive items lying around. It was easy to steal one of the furs. I don't know what he was considering, but I was like, That's interesting. And here I am telling him that he has left the money, like I could have stolen it. So he knows now that I'm even more trustworthy. Years later, when I had my own business, I suspected. One time, one of my customers gave me cash. So Rebecca knows the story. And when I went to the bank to deposit, I know it was short. I thought, Mom, that's interesting. Maybe I dropped the cash somewhere. And then later on, I start to suspect that one of my employees could have actually taken, it was in the van or whatever that day, could have just taken it easily. So one day I decided to do the same thing. I let some cash out to see if it will disappear. I had a camera on the room, and this employee actually covered the camera and money was missing again. But the person really literally covered it. I could see that like camera couldn't record that part of the video. So I had to let him go because I was kind of convinced that something is up. After I let him go, one of my employees told me later on that the guy that you let go used to, when we were traveling, we will go to a restaurant or whatever, when he would go to the bathroom, he would do drugs. So Jesus gives authority to his apostles, the 12 chosen. You don't give authority to everybody. You give to the ones that you trust. And out of the 12, Peter is the only one that I know actually has a record of raising somebody from the dead. In Acts chapter 9, he goes to a city called Lydda. A man named Ananias, bedridden for 8 years, Peter actually heals him. He's not bedridden anymore. And right after that, he goes to Joppa. He raises Tabitha from the dead. And as far as I know, that's the only record in the New Testament that other than Paul, I'm not talking about the 12 that Jesus chose, other than Paul, out of the 12, as far as I know, he's the only one that actually raises the dead. But I was thinking about it, but what was his greatest deed? Was it the raising the dead or healing somebody? Or he was entrusted with authority? That he walked on water? None of the apostles, other apostles walked on water because they didn't want to. They didn't care about it. They didn't think about it. Right? They were comfortable. They were safe in the boat. They didn't necessarily step out. I was thinking about, like, I think his greatest deed was the fact that he was entrusted with the keys to the kingdom of heaven, that he actually preaches and that 3,000 actually are baptized that day. Personally, I think that was one of the greatest things. And then later on, the church that he was part of becomes like 5,000 people. So we're going to talk about, why am I talking about all these things? Jesus called us to an extraordinary life. Do I care about walking on water? If God was to say, you want to walk on water? Go ahead and walk on water. You want to raise the dead? It's okay with me. If you want to raise the dead, go ahead and raise the dead. If God wants to tell me, I'm talking to myself, that you can heal the sick, I'm going to give you the powers and the authority to do so. Do I really care? Every time somebody says, so-and-so is sick, could you pray? You know what I'm thinking? It's not so much that they need to be healed, but why is God allowing it? What is God trying to teach? What does the person needs to know in this? Because God is sovereign. The person is not just sick randomly. Nothing, even the sparrow will not fall to the ground apart from the will of the Father. How could anybody be sick without the will of the Father? The question is, what do they need to learn? What is God trying to do in their own lives? And we do pray for their healing, but we also pray that they will learn the lesson, whatever that God is trying to teach, because God is sovereign God is sovereign. So why do I need to go heal somebody if God was to give me the powers, if he's already the one allowing it, that he allowed somebody to die? What would that do for me? if I was to even be able to do those things. But here is, I think, the greatest thing that I want to take part in. This is John chapter 14. I'm going to read 12 and 13 verses. If you want to turn there, it says, I tell you the truth, anyone who has faith in me will do what I've been doing. He will do even greater things than these, because I'm going to the Father. And I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Son may bring glory to the Father. You may ask me for anything in my name, and I will do it. You've heard it many times, and people have like tested this scripture. Oh, Jesus is going to do anything for me? Great. All I need is just faith. You know, sometimes you have to look into the scriptures a little more carefully. But before we do this, I'm going to tell you a story again. Today is my story day. In the 90s, when I was working for this guy in New York City, there was this, Verizon had the sweepstakes, and that you didn't have to buy anything. If you just mail a card for the next 20 days, that you could enter 20 times to win $20,000. I thought to myself, nobody's going to do this. My chances are really high. So I send a card in the 90s to Verizon sweepstakes. I made them all, and I put them the stamps on it, and I just put one into the mail. And I just pray that I'll win the $20,000. It wasn't a big amount of money, but I was in New York City. I was cash. I was poor. And guess what? I waited and waited and waited, and I didn't win it. And I thought to myself, wow, I really thought I'm going to win it. Then I remember later on, I heard a story in this church. There was a story. I heard it. I think a preacher maybe preached it, or I read it somewhere. So in this particular town, the car dealer had a sweepstake. He was giving away a car, and everybody at this particular church wanted to participate. So they were all praying. And the priest, the minister goes, I am praying. All of my members are praying. There's only one car to have. How is that going to work? Right? If there are 1,000 people in the church and there's one car to be given in this town, and there may be other churches in this town or other people, it's a brand new car. The guy's given a brand new car. How is this going to work? How is God going to work with this? And it just occurred to me that let's go back to the John 14 and let's hear what Jesus is saying. I tell you the truth. Anyone who has faith in me will do what I've been doing. He will do even greater things than these because I'm going to the Father. And I will do whatever you ask in my name so that the Son may bring glory to the Father. As long as whatever you're asking will bring glory to the Father, that Jesus will be able to bring glory to the Father with whatever you're asking, he will do it. As long as whatever you're asking, through which Jesus will bring glory to the Father, he will do it. So if you want a Ferrari and you pray for it, is Jesus going to be bringing glory to the Father through you getting a Ferrari or a $20 million? If the answer is no, you're not getting it. That's not what he's talking about. Jesus is saying, as long as Jesus can bring glory, I'm saying repeating because it seems like it's hidden into the sentence. As long as Jesus can bring glory to the Father through whatever you're asking, you will receive it. In Luke chapter 19, Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. Jesus came to earth. He had one goal. To bring, to seek, and to save what was lost. He was looking for the sons of Abraham. Sons of Abraham. Who are the sons of Abraham? We learned about Abraham and his descendants. And what did we learn about Abraham? Abraham left his home because God told him to, trusted God, and traveled to a land that he did not know. Abraham, when he was promised, he trusted the promises. Abraham was asked to walk blamelessly. He got into the covenant of circumcision through that. God told him to give up the most precious thing that he has, his son, on Mount Moriah. He was willing to give up the most precious thing that he had because he loved God more than his son. Jesus is looking for these kind of people. He's going to seek them. He's going to save them. Not anybody. He's looking for people of faith who will give up their own lives because they trust in what is coming, just like Abraham trusted what he did not see. He's going to look for those kind of people through me and through you. If you are availing yourself, he's going to use you to seek and to save those kind of people from any nation of the world. Let's continue to develop the concept. The Son wants to bring glory to the Father. And anything we ask in that, he's going to give it to us. John chapter 15, verse 7. Look what he says. If you remain in me, my words remain in you. Ask whatever you wish, and it will be given to you. This is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourself to be my disciples. This is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourself to be my disciples. So if you are bearing much fruit, it is to his Father's glory. How? There's one person thanking God, or three people thanking God, or 1,000 people thanking God. One person praising God, three people praising God, 1,000 people praising God. One person singing to God, three people singing to God, 1,000 people singing to God. Isn't it to God's glory? The more the praise, the more the singing, more the thanksgiving because what God has done? Isn't to his glory? John 15, 16, you did not choose me, but I chose you and appoint you to go and bear fruit that will last, that the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. If your goal is to bring glory to the Father, you have a blank card, basically. That's what Jesus is saying. Because that makes two of us, Jesus says. I want to bring glory to the Father. You want to bring glory to the Father. Ask whatever you want. And guess what? You're going to do greater things than I have done. In his lifetime, Jesus did not have 3,000 followers. He did not. Paul did. Peter did more than Jesus did, if you think about it. And we will do greater things than Jesus, as long as we understand what he's talking about. So what are we to do? What is Jesus teaching us? We are to seek and to save that is lost. It will bring glory to the Father when they come to the Father and they have a relationship with God. They love God. They sing songs to God. They give thanks to God. It is to his glory, not to our glory, to his glory. The more the better for God. You're going to say, man, that's an impossible task. Exactly my point. Peter shouldn't be walking on the water. Nobody should be walking on the water. But we're followers of Jesus. He will make us walk on water. We will do incredible things if he is in us. We will achieve greater things than he did if Jesus is in you. You're going to have an extraordinary life. And you're going to see things, great things happening in your life. But get it right. Get it right. It's not necessarily for you to, again, I don't know, just list whatever that God may or may not think that, you know, it's going to really do much, right? Some people would justify, if I have $1 million, I'll serve God with it. But God also knows that it will be your ruin if you had $1 million, and it will spare you, just like you don't get anything to your children if they ask you. So I'll start concluding here that, so we will bring glory to the Father, just like Jesus did, but we have to go make disciples. We have to go and seek. I'll use the word seek. When you seek, what do? What is the act of seeking? You're looking for them. They're not just going to come to you. We have to go out and look for them. And then save them. How do we save them? Seek and save. Well, how do we save them? We study the Bible with them. And then they will show to be true sons of Abraham. If they're not, they're not going to last. It says, I appointed you to go and bear fruit that will last. You want your fruit to last? What does it mean to last? That means that they're going to make it to their end without falling away. You want them to last? You have to find the people that Jesus was looking for. And you need to be the kind of person like Abraham, yourself, willing to love God more than the most precious thing you have, willing to give up anything and everything for him. Because, and have faith that God will reward you. If you are not this kind of person, neither you will make it as a fruit, you will not last, nor the people that you're going to bring will last. As soon as there's persecution, they'll walk away. As soon as there's a challenge or a temptation, they'll walk away. And after we seek and save, this is what Jesus is asking us. John chapter 15, verse 12, my command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Verse 17, this is my command, love each other. John 17, 12, while I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe. 15, my prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. So, to summarize everything I'm saying, we have to seek, we have to save, and then we have to love them and protect them while we are on earth. And while we cannot protect them, we pray for them, we fast for them, and we entrust that God will protect them. When we cannot, when they're beyond our reach. And this is how we bring glory to the Father. If there's a million disciples, million sons of daughters of God on earth, there's million more people to admire him and love him and to appreciate what he has done and what Jesus has done. I'll clarify this and I'll conclude it. Let me just make sure you don't mishear me. Your purpose on earth is not about going and making disciples. You have one purpose. You were created to be a son of God. Your purpose is to have a relationship with God and love him and enjoy him. But this is the work that he has left for us. This is the work that he has left for us. While you're on earth, this is the work. That's not your purpose. You weren't created for this. Your purpose is in the Garden of Eden. You're created to have an unobstructed relationship with your Father. That is the purpose you're made. But while you're on earth, this was Jesus' work, and we want to take part in that work. And you will have extraordinary lives. Every time Peter looked at the waters of Galilee, he said, I walked on that. Every time I walked on that water. And guess what? There are 12 witnesses of it, including Jesus. We will do incredible things. We will do greater things than Jesus. But get a perspective. If you're seeking God's glory, if you're allowing Jesus who lives in you, will try to bring glory to the Father through your life if you avail him. And you will do greater things than Jesus did. And I will do greater things than Jesus did. And children, you will do greater things than Jesus did. But you have to understand, you have to allow him to be in you, to avail your life, give up your life, so that he can show you how you can walk on water.